Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 51 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I spoke with Dr. Hamish Cameron, a lecturer in classics at Victoria University of Wellington. He specializes in the history and geography of the Roman Near East, representations of imperialism in ancient Greek and Latin literature, and the reception of the ancient Mediterranean world in modern games. He has recently published on the pedagogy of tabletop games and has forthcoming chapters and articles on Assassin's Creed Origins, Assassin's Creed Odyssey, and Hades. In today's episode, we chatted about how to be a classicist and game designer, the differences between the U.S. and New Zealand academic systems, and shared our thoughts on anachronistic adaptations of ancient material versus hyper-accurate depictions. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy! Hello and welcome to Ancient Office Hours. Thank you so much for joining me this morning or night or, you know, what is time. I just want to jump right in and ask you a little bit about how you discovered classics. Like, how did you get into it? Because it is kind of niche that I feel like a lot of people don't know about until you tell them.
That's a tricky question. I try not to be identified by my job, right? I feel like people should make their identities that is something that isn't kind of constricted by capitalism. And chronologically, I would call myself a gamer first. But in terms of like the importance of the two things that I do that I both do professionally, I'm a classicist primarily professionally, and then the game design I fit in around the stuff. So both. In that infuriating way that my students hate. So I'm a New Zealander, and I did all my undergraduate and previous education in New Zealand. And I think in New Zealand, classics has a slightly higher profile. It is a high school subject that you can legitimately take. And so people know it a little bit more than they do in other places, perhaps, certainly more than in the US, I think, where maybe it's more common for people to take Latin. I did a classics course in high school, but I didn't really think of it. It was just like a side thing. It wasn't my main thing at all. There was a slightly convoluted backstory to it, but I ended up taking history in undergrad, and I took medieval history because I wanted to be a medieval historian. And I thought, okay, well, I need to know Latin so I can read medieval manuscripts. And so I took Latin, and then I was like, wow, the Romans are cool. So I changed teams. And then I basically did all the classics classes as well, and then did honors and MA and blah, blah, blah. And I just didn't stop. Yeah. And part of the reason that I decided to do medieval history was that I'd always been into history, but I'd never really thought of it as a subject that I could do, or I'd always done like sciencey stuff really up and all through high school. And here high school is a bit more focused maybe than it is in the US, where it's quite general. Not as focused as it is in some places in Europe, for sure, where you like really have to pick a stream early on. Yeah, so I'd been into history, and I always was reading history books and doing historical gaming things from an early age. And so part of what got me into classics ultimately was taking medieval history, because I was interested in game things, and medievalisms are a big thing in classics. So it's interesting. So I can say it was D&D that got me into classics. That's probably too much. It's probably too much to say that. But
really? Oh my goodness. That's a new one. And that's really exciting for me, because I never get to say that, oh, that's a new one. I've never heard that entry sort of into classics. So I deeply appreciate that. And I have so many D&D like player friends that I know would deeply appreciate that as well.
They can be very complicated, but sometimes there are a lot that are simpler. There's a role-playing game for everyone, no matter what your background and your style and how you want to do it. It's just a matter of finding the right one.
Which is totally valid, because they are awesome. I mean, really, I wish more people would be like into them, but like, I understand it's like it is kind of complicated. I will admit that I am not a D&D player. I am so sorry. Played a handful of tabletop RPGs, but when I have, they're really fun. They're so complicated sometimes. Like, you actually have to really like make you think in a way. And then you're like, wait, there's like levels to this. I still have friends who are just like, I don't even know what that is. So I feel like I'm in a pretty good spot. I'm like, I at least know what it is. I've always loved video games, but it took me a long time to like find the right ones, I guess. Cause like, I don't know, for a while I would just kind of tell, like play or try what people would tell me. And I'd be like, I guess that was fun or cool. But, you know, people just obviously have really different tastes in mm-hmm. games. So I would always end up with like, I really like certain like 4X type of city builder things. But I would say, you know, again, I like the like specific ones. So I like Civilization, but people were telling me to do like SimCity. And I was kind of just like, I'd play it for like an hour and then I'd get really bored and be like, why would anyone play this? This is so boring. And then I remember Pharaoh came out. And I don't even remember when, but I remember that came out and then I saw it and I begged my parents and I was like, I have to have this. Can I? And my parents were super like against video games. You know, they were like part of that older generation that was like, no, 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 all games mush your brain. So no, you can not have or own or play video games. That was a bit rough. I had to wait. And I was like, but where's the logic? I'm a child, so therefore I must be able to play child games. These are games for children. Surprisingly, or maybe unsurprisingly, that logic did not work on my parents. They were just like, no, you can read. You can go out and play. And I was like, okay, okay. So delayed gratification. But with that, actually, if games sort of got you into classics, you know, is it fair to say that like your parents had not as big of a problem as mine with you and gaming?
I had to wait till I was 3 to play a game. Ugh. No. It's only really, I think there's an outside chance that my mother will listen to this podcast, actually. So I'm not gonna rip on my mom. It was skeptical, I think, of the amount of games that I played, particularly at high school, where I probably played more games than I did actually high school work. But it worked out all right. And I think now that I've published games and have like produced physical things, that's like, here is a 300 page book that I have written and that people buy, that gives a certain amount of credibility to the thing. And that's definitely not to say that everybody needs to monetize their hobby, because that's a special type of thing. And I think, you know, in the modern sort of gig economy style thing, there's sort of pressure to monetize everything you do, and that's potentially quite bad, but you know, it works for me in this particular case.
No, that's awesome. Lucky you. Luckily, we've established now that your parents, they didn't care enough to like stop you, make a concerted effort to stop you from gaming, which is awesome. You know, how did they feel about your interest in classics, though? Because I mean, yes, obviously in New Zealand, classics is received differently. It's really awesome that it's a high school subject. I wish I had that in high school. We just have like a general world history that will cover some aspects of Rome and Greece. But then, you know, you do actually have to do the rest of the world too. So you don't have a lot of time to focus just on the ancient Mediterranean. Is it the same kind of, oh no, there's that existential dread that, you know, you'll be poor and that you can't really make a career out of classics? Is there that like mentality in New Zealand, or is it much more chill? Like, Yeah, it's like this. It's received the same as like, you know, saying you want to go major in like English or something, where people are like, oh, okay, that's hard. But like, sure, it's just another liberal art. So go ahead.
I think by the time that I started doing classics, my parents were really just happy to see me doing a subject that I was interested in and actually like applying myself to, which had not necessarily been the case with some of my previous studies. The sort of history classics intersection was the place where I sort of found myself intellectually, I guess. That was a positive thing that they were very supportive of.
That sounds about right, I would say. I'm always very curious. Once you get into class, once anyone gets into classics, you know, the way that you curate kind of your passions and find your topic is always a really interesting process. So, you know, how did you go from this broad world of, if classics is an entire buffet table of gorgeous, delicious looking goodies, they have this separate table full of the biscuits. And then you're like, okay, I need the biscuits from this small table before I can go onto the main table and then find all the delicious foods.
It's the person who comes through a line in a restaurant that has a queue outside and you're like, oh, would you like a tiny bit of pancake while you wait to get inside the restaurant and have your big pancakes? Like, yes, I would. Thank you very much.
How do you choose your main dish? You know, what's your chicken? How did you find your specialty and how did you decide?
I mean, I think most people do classics in an environment that has a relatively small number of like specialists in the department. And so I think there's an extent to which you're naturally going to tend to head in the direction that is available. Like if people are offering advanced courses on some aspect of the classical world, then that's the direction you're likely to take. So I have a long-standing interest in ancient religion and sort of ancient history in a technical German sense that I don't actually do that much now, but that's sort of where I started back in my original undergrad institution. Obviously, once you get to a PhD point and you really get to pick something for yourself, even then you still have to have somebody around who can supervise the topics. My specialty, as far as what I did for my PhD, was the Roman Near East and classical geography and borderlands all sort of mashed together. And I guess my advisor was mostly just an ancient historian. I mean, not just, she's great. She's an ancient historian without a specialty necessarily in those things, although she has specialties in areas that are sort of adjacent to those. So you get at that point to sort of start forging your own identity and focusing on topics that are parallel, sprouting from maybe the trunk of it, of whatever the things you've done. I certainly got to a point when I think I'd finished writing my PhD proposal, and I was into the actual work, and I suddenly realized, hey, all of my grad school courses line up, actually. They all kind of point. Like, I did this course on religious space. I did a GIS certificate. I did these other things. Like, oh, they all kind of poked their way towards thinking deeply about geography and space and the margins alongside kind of state structures and this sort of thing. And it was that there was this moment specifically where I was able to construct a narrative out of the disparate things that I'd come from that were pointing in a direction that I then went. And it's a direction that I still kind of go in, but I taught at Bates College, liberal arts college, for 3 years before I came back to New Zealand. And thinking about a liberal arts college, constructing courses for a liberal arts environment where the vibe is a little bit different in terms of the kind of classes you can offer, that's where I suddenly was like, hey, wait, I can bring in my game stuff here too and think about that in an interesting academic way and really tie that into classics in a way that is appealing to students and useful, like intellectually, for them to think through. So I guess there's the getting there through what is available to you and following paths that people are sort of laying for you and then starting to branch off yourself. And then eventually, once you're confident enough in what you're doing, just like heading out for that other dessert table, like that other part of the buffet in the next room that you're maybe not supposed to go to, but now you can because who's going to stop you?
Oh, I love that. I love how you brought this really great answer back to food. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm still so hung up on the food thing, but it's fantastic. And I love it so much.
Food is great. That's what your podcast is about now. It's a food word that rhymes with Ozymandias.
Yeah, no, I think that's really cool and really interesting, but I think it's also really good to hear because I think one of the top things I hear, especially coming from the US, is there's a lot of concern from students that like, Oh, but classics, it just feels like there's like two ways you hear of it. It's either the path is already set out for me because I'm, you know, going to be stuck taking these like standard courses. So I can't put my, you know, individual spin on anything. And I just have to take what's there, which people obviously are kind of like, I don't really want to do that. Or there's some people who are like, you know, it's too broad and there's so many course offerings that I don't know how I would center it on, you know, one specific focus. And then I've had conversations with people in my department who felt like, you know, it took them at least the first 3 years of undergrad to kind of figure out, you know, okay, what path am I taking? And I mean, I was just lucky that my university was one where you didn't have to like declare your major or your track until like halfway through junior year. So like you're 3.5 years in before you have to actually make a decision. Yeah. So I find it interesting how some people really appreciated that and some people really didn't like it. And they were kind of like, I wish they forced me to pick something a little earlier just because it would help, you know, set their own direction. And I would say I kind of ended up in that camp because I mean, I sort of knew where I wanted to go, but by junior year, my path was just really unorthodox and there were some, I had some health issues and then there was like study abroad that was factoring in. So essentially I like didn't declare essentially my track until the last moment possible. Also, I ended up doing a fifth year in college. So technically my timeline was also set back. So I had the time built in, but I ended up getting like health issues right when I was supposed to be starting my languages. And I was like, well, this is a really crucial component if you want to be, you know, in philology, if you want to do the Greek track or the Latin track, because I missed some school, I like didn't have time. So then I kind of was forced into picking like the classical civilizations track. Essentially, I don't really know how they let me do this, but I just know that they let me graduate without taking an ancient language. I did fit in eventually a semester of ancient Greek, but that's really unorthodox for most classicists. So yeah, I was like, don't do what I did, kids. Choose early. But it is it is nice to know that, you know, you can like put your own spin on things. It's not like a set destiny. Like, yes, you do have to play nice with what is available to you at your institution. How big is your classics department? Ours, even for a huge university, was quite small because, you know, classics is not super popular subject, which I find obviously really sad. But what, you know, what is a big state school in the middle of like rural Missouri going to really do about that? So I know that you also do game design. So since you were thinking, you were already in that mindset of, you know, video games and historical video games. And then, you know, it's just like perfect that you happen to be doing this like super awesome academic degree. I know archaeogaming as a subfield is quite new comparatively to like the rest of the field. So, you know, were you already thinking though, when you were like going through your PhD of like ways to integrate games, or were they still quite separate at that time to you where you were like, I have one here and I have my other interest here and they kind of, you know, can talk to each other, but not really?
Yeah, no, they were quite different. I mean, whenever you move countries to, for any reason, frankly, but to go into a PhD program, which is what I did, you're suddenly thrust into a whole new environment. You have to make a whole new set of friends. I mean, this is not just about PhD programs, right? Obviously, this is a thing that you encounter all sorts of times through your life, different times. But as somebody who is into mostly analog games, so tabletop stuff, I guess aside from the community they had of grad students in the place that I'd moved, any other friends I made outside that, it was quite easy to do through gaming, right? I'd go to a game convention and meet people, right? And so the game stuff was really that kind of thing that I did outside of university to keep myself sane for the doing the PhD thing, right? And I think it's really important for grad students to not just do the thing that they're studying, right? And to have a life outside that, if only for, I guess, the balance, right? Or keeping yourself like feeling the pressure of grad school all the time, right? So you can try and step outside that as much as possible, which is very hard. But yeah, so they were very much separate things. I hadn't really thought about integrating them at all until I started writing job applications for liberal arts college, actually, because then I was starting to think about like, oh, what would be a innovative way to do something different in a classroom, right? That could not just like, okay, here's Roman history, blah, 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 blah. And it was when I was in that kind of environment that then I was really thinking about it. They were definitely entirely separate things. And for a while, the game thing was my plan B as well. Like, oh, if I decide that I don't want to finish this PhD, or I can't finish, like if I fail the PhD or something like that, right? Then what am I going to do? And so there was a moment where I was like, okay, how much money do I need to make from this in order to live in some super cheap place in the middle of New Zealand, right? Where there's no, like, you know, those doing that sort of calculation at times, because when you're in a grad program, you have the moments where you're like, is this all worth it? Could I be using my life better than this? And as it turned out, I'm pretty happy with the way it turned out for me, but I am lucky in that I got a permanent job at the end of it. So that is absolutely a super lucky thing. And I feel grateful for that constantly every time I think about it, especially right now.
No, for sure. And I mean, that is something that, you know, I have friends in PhD programs and they're like literally looking at this job market, this world, and they're just going, you know, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could get a job either in my field or even something related. So I have a lot of friends who are kind of confronting maybe they should look outside of the field. I have one friend who her joke is she's just going to move to Silicon Valley and work for Google and then make a nice big fat paycheck. And then she'll just, you know, go to Greece or Egypt or somewhere exciting for like 2 months in the summer. And then that's how she'll stay connected to the classics world. And I was like, you know, that doesn't sound half bad, actually. I'll work outside of the field if it means like taking 2 months off to just go vacation through all my ideal destinations.
One of the things that's most important about doing a PhD program actually is understanding that the job market is rubbish and being open to other possibilities as you go through. Like, okay, this classics PhD is intellectually good for me and I am enjoying it. And if I decide that any part of it, any part of the surrounding stuff or the job market is bullshit.
No, you can swear.
Then like pull the plug, right? And I mean, you want to push yourself in a program, but not at the expense of your health and not at the expense of all of the various other ways that a PhD program can apply pressure to you or be a toxic environment. And I think it's important to have a sort of clear sense about what your boundaries are, frankly. And how to navigate that. And that's tough. I think overall it makes the process more rewarding if you're not thinking, I am only successful if I come out of this with a tenure track job. Because the reality is that most people are not going to come out of it with a tenure track job. But they are going to come out of it having spent several years doing something they love, hopefully, and with a PhD that they can then apply for other things. Or without a PhD if they don't want to go all that way or can't go all that way for whatever reason, that there's still like intellectual value and they are not a lesser person for not having not having reached the golden apple at the end, right? That's just one of the many outcomes that you can have. And I think we as a field need to be better about supporting that.
No, I think that's a really valid point. I mean, I'm currently in grad school, but I'm not for classics. I've definitely confronted that even at the master level. Sometimes, you know, I will be, let's see, next week is finals week. So, you know, we're going to go into it and kind of just actually freaking out so badly about, you know, what is going to happen with my finals.
You're going to own it, Lexi.
Thank you.
You're going to own it. You're going to eat the best cake on the buffet table and you're going to be like, yes, I'm covered in cake and I'm a winner.
Yes. Okay. I love it. Love the positivity. Yes, that's what I'm here for. So yes, I will have finals but it's like, there's no rest for the weary is what I'm telling everyone, because I finish my finals, I have a term paper due in early June that I then need to finish. And then after that, I get to start writing my thesis. So I'm like, there's literally no rest for the weary. So I'll be writing my thesis all summer and then hopefully I will be submitting it on time at the end of September, and then hopefully I will pass and get my master's. But it's like, you know, even me just sitting here thinking like, oh no, what did I do to myself? Should I have taken this like accelerated 1 year program? I know that traditionally in the US our master's programs are 2 years, so you don't sit here after 1 year being like, oh my gosh, it's all on me now, or you know, now or never. You know, I think it's really good to hear a perspective of like, it's okay. It's reassuring, you know, to hear you haven't failed in life if for whatever reason it doesn't work out. Now I'm pretty confident it will work out, just because I believe in myself, but at the same time, things happen. So it's very good to hear. But like with that though, you know, when going into a PhD program, I know that there's also like a taboo about things like ABD status. Why? I'm constantly fascinated with why people don't really want to talk about it. Why is it not normalized? Like maybe it's not a thing in New Zealand. Maybe it's not taboo, but in the States, like I've noticed there's definitely like a trend of people being like, there's this mindset of like, you went to school and you got the thing, or you went mm-hmm. to school and then you sort of tried and then you just sort of quit. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by a taboo?
I guess like people are always like willing to talk about the success, right? But then it's taboo in that like you don't want to talk about how you went to get the thing, and then because it's kind of just like considered you almost made it over the mountaintop, but then you stopped.
Right.
And so, you know, if you don't.
So you mean a taboo on admitting that that's as far as you got and then you stopped?
Yeah. And just like you don't want to like admit that really in a okay. job or like, you know, and I think that anything that you do, I think it's worthwhile. So like, I wouldn't be afraid to, you know, go to like a job interview or something and be like, oh yeah, I went to school. I was trying to get my PhD. I attained all but dissertation status. Oh, but you know what? Like I didn't finish, you know, and I don't know why like you not finishing would make you somehow less qualified to like do a job. But for whatever reason, yeah. people would be like, oh, okay. Interesting. And like move yeah. on.
I mean, I think if somebody thinks like that, you probably don't want to work for them or with them, frankly. That seems weird to me. I think the main thing, if you are in the position where you have got as far as ABD and then decided to leave, then think clearly about why you decided to leave and make that part of your narrative about your job. Like, so that when they ask, oh, so it says here that you were ABD, but you didn't finish your PhD. Why is that? Don't say, oh, because I was too lazy to finish my PhD, which is never going to be the reason. Maybe it's that you reevaluated what you wanted in life, and what you wanted in life is to do this other thing, right? And that's like, people change their minds about what they're doing, what they want to do with their lives, or what career path they want to take all the time. But yeah, I think this is part of the problem, that often when people, there's something about the whole grad school process, the internal reinforcement, I guess, of the idea that, okay, right, you're in the tube now. When you come out of the other end, you're going to be a doctor. And if you're not, then I guess you failed. A, that's not healthy, and B, that's not accurate. The other way around, even. But at any rate, I don't think people outside of PhD programs think like that. I think people in the quote-unquote real world, yeah, I think people who are not in academia don't have that same hang-up, right? I think that's very much a grad school, internal grad school hang up that maybe some people who go on into academia continue. The like, oh, well, I got my PhD, so why don't you just knuckle down and work harder? Because clearly that's all you need to do, right? That attitude that you sometimes see, I think that's toxic and that's bullshit and, you know, shouldn't listen to it. If you spent 4 out of 5 years or 7 out of 5 years or 10 out of 5 years working on something and then decided that you didn't want to take the next step, good on you. You made a decision, and work out what you want to do with your life and then make that into your into your narrative. That would be my advice.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really is a very like highly academic thing to think, mm-hmm. you know, oh, this person is not good enough just because they didn't finish the thing. But we don't like people just don't talk about, which is, you know, scholars and their like people in academia are usually so in academia that it's very hard to think non-academically someone who isn't in it, because I will sit here sometimes and I'll be on a conversation with family and I'll say something that's probably a super academic worry about perception or something, you know, and people will be like, how did you get there? Because I would never assume this, or I would never think that, or that's just not, you know, mm-hmm. like normal for anyone else. And I'm like, wait, really? So there also is like, there's like the classics bubble or ancient world bubbles, what I call it, mm-hmm. just because I'm mm-hmm. like, we often just get so set in like the mindset of, you know, how we were taught, or, you know, the mm-hmm. things that you see. And then, you know, it's like, oh, wait, it's okay. I had to be reminded that alternative tracks to academia is like a valid thing. So when I graduated, and then when people were like, what do you mean you're not going to continue on in classics mm-hmm. at the graduate level? I was like, no, I'm going to just find other ways in my life to be classics adjacent, you know, and people were kind of just like, oh, okay. And I guess I hadn't been expecting my non-academic friends and family to just be like, oh no, that's awesome. Like, that's great. I was kind of sitting here being like, oh God, they're going to think I'm like the failed classicist who's just like the wannabe just doing other things because, you know, I couldn't make it. You know, that was like a highly specific fear, but it was completely unfounded. I mean, you know, there are definitely advantages to be alternative academia. I mean, I know it worked out for you, but like, was there a point where you were seriously looking into alt-ac, or did things sort of just happen in a way where you didn't have to actually, you didn't have long enough to worry about that?
No, it definitely did. As I was getting close to the end of my PhD, I never had American citizenship or residency beyond my student status or whatever jobs I had after that. So there was definitely a moment at the end of my PhD where I was like, okay, what am I going to do next with a classics PhD? Because in America, I think there's more you can do with a PhD maybe than there is here. That's probably not true. That's just probably because I haven't really looked at what, or tested the job market here in New Zealand with a PhD. And I do, certainly know several PhD having friends in New Zealand who have jobs in, say, government agencies or what have you. So that's really just my own thing. But I was looking into other options. I was looking into high school teaching. I was looking into other types of things that one might do. Nothing really game related, although I guess I did kind of look into that a little bit, not in a super serious way. And then as it turns out, I managed to cobble together a series of like local things in LA for a bit, and then got onto the sort of train of, oh, here's a VAP, here's a non-tenure track position, that sort of thing. And it was, I mean, it was really skin of the teeth stuff the whole way through. Like, I was a couple of times a matter of weeks from moving back to New Zealand before I got a job offer, like right at the sort of point where I would have had to actually make a decision. There was one trip that my now wife and I took back to New Zealand where it was, when we originally planned it, it was like, okay, this is a, let's go back to New Zealand because we're probably moving here. So what do you think of it? And maybe I'll throw like some things around. And when I was there, or just before we left on that trip, I got a job offer for a thing in America. So there was lots of that. It definitely wasn't like a smooth path. When I look back, like my CV says that it was a smooth path, but that just obscures the reality of being very close to edges a lot of the way through. And I think it's like that for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I think CVs are really funny, because when you look at them, you know, everyone, they work so hard to curate it, so it just looks like wonderful and perfect and it flows. And then, you know, ask anyone and they're like, I had to cobble this thing together because, yeah, oh my gosh, I just got lucky or this happened. And oh my goodness, you know, I was stressed that I wouldn't be able to fill up my CV because I thought I'd be, you know, poor without a job or opportunity. Mm-hmm. So that I definitely understand. So I want to get a little into, so I know you said that you've worked on a couple of games, and obviously we've established that gaming is also a big part of, you know, just what you like and, you know, who you are. So I want to ask you a little bit about the games that you've worked on.
Sure.
You know, how did those opportunities come along? It's hard to walk a line between gaming and classics, you know, as like two separate things, but also being able to work them into what you do. So I think that's really awesome. And I'm sure a lot of other people would be like, wait, classics and gaming? How do I do that? How do I do both?
Yeah, yeah. So for the most part, I have been a tabletop gamer since I was like 10 or something like that. And when you're a tabletop gamer, you tend to tinker with game design quite a lot. If you're GMing things, it's like, oh, well, I want to make the special rule for this thing that I want to bring into my game or whatever. Like, it's very much that kind of that vibe, that sort of like indie do-it-yourself thing. I was really interested from about the early 2000s in the sort of burgeoning indie game movement that was really coming about. And then when Vincent Baker released Apocalypse World, and it sort of like grabbed the scene by the scruff of the neck, really. And a whole lot of people were like really interested in what the game could do and how you could easily turn it into other things other than what it did. And about that time, that was a moment where I just sort of had a bit of time to fiddle around with things, and something caught my imagination. I just started working on it. And so then I published my first game, which is called The Sprawl, which is a cyberpunk game that is sort of related to my work in that as an ancient historian and classicist, I'm really interested in the way that societies work, in the way that why people do things, how ideologies work in terms of like ancient societies. And so when I'm thinking about a genre like cyberpunk that is about sort of modern capitalism turned up to 11 and how those ideologies work and how they oppress people, and those are like interconnected social things, right? There is a connection there intellectually between those two things, but there was nothing historical about it other than the fact that I am an ancient historian and a classicist who is trained to read texts really closely. So the way that I wrote the game was basically like reading the core texts of the genre really closely and then pulling out the things that I would want to like turn into a game. I was lucky enough that that sort of hit at a moment that a lot of other people were interested in that thing that I was doing, became successful. And on the back of that, I've done a few other things. None of the published ones yet have been historical or classical in any way, but they're all using that same sort of skills of like, how do I close reading of a genre and apply that in a different system? Like, there's a way to which game design is translation. In the same way, actually, that geography is translation. These are the three things that I think about a lot. When you're translating, you're looking at one text and you're trying to encapsulate the meaning in a different language. And there's never just a one-to-one thing, right? It's always like, okay, what are the range of meanings that Virtus has? Which one of those meanings do I think is most applicable in this translation I'm doing right now? And you're doing that all the time. And game design is kind of similar. Like, what are the things here out of this range of things that I think are the most important to focus on? Now, how do I turn that thing into a game form, right? How do I make that fun to do in a way that enables people to engage with it? And I'm going through this sort of like process with Roman stuff at the moment because I'm working on a Roman game for the first time. Whenever anybody hears that I'm an ancient historian in the game world, they're like, oh, do you play games about Rome? I'm like, no, because I never want to be that guy who's like, that's not historically accurate. So clearly the way to get around that is to write my game, write my own game. And I'm actually collaborating on that with a colleague here, not a classicist. But that's also good because it means that I'm not just stuck in like classicist world. I'm getting input from elsewhere. We're working on that collaboratively, which is cool. I forget where I started with that question. Did I answer your question then?
Yeah, no, I think you got to the heart of it. I mean, that's pretty cool. I was just interested in what kind of games you were doing because, you know, it's a completely different world to classics, and it's not what I would immediately think of something adjacent that, you know, you can just attack on. You know, it's not like you're doing classics and then, oh, you know what, I'm just going to add some art history, which is totally what I did because I did end up getting a minor in art history. They're quite different, but I like it because, you know, you get that double dipping of like you have your nice humanities, but then you do have your like STEM-y sort of field, whatever. I find it interesting. So, you know, okay, yeah. You don't want to be that person who just criticizes ancient world games. I don't know, like we have a lot of traditional video games, you know, like the Assassin's Creed games that people can immediately go see for the gratification of, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to go into this digital world and play in ancient Rome or ancient Greece or whatever. Traditionally, I guess when we think about video games and if they were to come into the classroom, you know, you would want something visually sort of applies to it. But do you see there being a good way to bring historically based and accurate, hopefully, tabletop RPG games into a classroom? Like, I know that I'm really interested in how do you bring all forms of gaming and not just stick to sort of one dimensional, you know, standard digital RPG. So, and I'd be really just interested to hear, you know, how would one bring a tabletop RPG into a classroom and have it be more than just like a random fun game or experience you play once and then don't relate to?
Sure. Yeah. Well, okay. So I've taught three classes over the years that have done this with different types of games. The first time I did it, it was focused on tabletop role-playing games. The second time it was focused on tabletop board games. And the one that I'm actually currently teaching right now is focused on video games. And if there's one important thing to get from all of them, it's that it doesn't matter how accurate the game is. What matters is what it's doing with the ancient world. Because the answer, oh, how accurate is that game? It's the same as with film. How accurate is Rome? Well, it's pretty accurate in some ways and pretty inaccurate in other ways. And that's basically the answer you give to everything. It's kind of all right, but not perfect, right? None of these are texts that they're not sources that you can assign and expect the student to get, just read. In the same way that you don't give Tacitus to someone and say, there you go, read Tacitus. Now you know about the ancient world. You have to talk about, like, okay, who was Tacitus? What was his context? What are his stylistic things? What are his biases? What is he leaving out? What is he including? It's the same with games. So with Assassin's Creed, like, what are they choosing to represent as the ancient world? Why do they think that represents the ancient world? How are they using those things to represent the ancient world? What are they leaving out? What are they not talking about? These are the kind of questions that I want my students to ask. And these are the kind of questions that make just about any historical game, no matter how bad it is, quote unquote, and some of them are pretty bad, that's what makes them interesting to teach with. That it's a thing that you are teaching to and around and with, not just a standalone thing on its own.
No, that's awesome. I think that's super awesome. And I'd like to see more people experiment with more than just video games. I think it'd be really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be really, really fun. And I agree that it's more important about the experience itself and, like, how you get people to interact with the ancient world than to focus on its accuracy. I mean, I remember I had this really amazing professor in undergrad. It wasn't like a game per se. She brought in aspects of role playing. So it was a class on, like, murder, mayhem, and images of justice in ancient Greece. And it was all about learning, you know, the ancient law systems and trials.
Mm-hmm.
And she just, I remember she was like, okay, guys, we're gonna reenact these famous trials. Everyone gets to role play, go away, prepare a thing, and
that's a game.
Come back and, you know, we'll do it. It was fantastic. I mean, people were, like, really invested in it. And I definitely can, like, think back and say, like, those were probably the most fun classes because we were, you know, invested in it.
Yeah, anything that, like, gets, you know, because that's the goal of teaching, right? You've got to get the students invested in their own learning. And so if that happens by, here's a fun exercise, and now that you have been assigned the role of Socrates, you have to go and read about Socrates so that you can portray Socrates correctly. Bam, I just got you to do research. Without, like, okay, here's a boring essay topic, which I then have to mark a million of them. Yeah, no, I've used that kind of thing in class as well, like a live role-playing game. I had a colleague up in Maine who wrote one, and I ran it for my class as a sort of, like, playtest. The class pretended to be Roman senators for 4 weeks. And in doing so, they had to read about things and write things about the period and the time and then enact them in the classroom and then reflect on their experiences and reflect on what happened in the classroom and what was accurate about it and what wasn't accurate, what limitations there were, how some things maybe could never come across in that kind of format and some things could. There's a ton of stuff you can get out of that sort of exercise. And yeah, I would say that if you are assigning people roles and there's an element of improvisation about it, then it's a role-playing game. It's somewhere on the role-playing game spectrum, right? Between live-action game and crunchy tabletop war game or something right there. It's somewhere in there. Yeah, so that's great.
And I love the scalability of it because that was what I had in undergrad and it was great. And, you know, we just kind of came in as ourselves and we just sort of gave the speeches and whatever. But when I was in sixth grade, I had this amazing teacher who wanted us to really get in character. So, you know, it came down to, like, bring in a bed sheet, make it into a mm-hmm. freaking toga. And then you can, like, go and act with your classmates and, like, really, like, hype that up and be like, now I am a Roman senator or I am an ancient Greek. So I love the scalability. So you could do it with, like, younger children at, like, the middle school level, high school level, and then you can do it in the undergrad. You can even do it in the grad level, which I love. I don't know if it's, like, something inherent to, like, gamers per se, but I definitely found myself gravitating toward the extracurriculars that have heavy role-playing elements.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
like, while my friend would be like, oh yes, I'm going to go to knitting club, I don't know, I just picked a random thing, but I mean, and I love knitting, so that is not an insult to knitting, but yeah, she would be like, okay, I'm gonna do ballet, I'm gonna do knitting club, whatever. I wanted to do Model UN, you know, and I had friends who wanted to do mock trial, and when people would be like, oh, why are you volunteering to do super academic clubs? They were like, don't you want to do less work? Wouldn't you rather, like, go play some ultimate frisbee or some, like, flag football and join one of those clubs? And I was like, yeah, they're fun. And it's, like, you know, it's active and they're not less valid, but there's the whole role-playing element that you go to conferences for, like Model UN, and I get to literally pretend to be a delegate of a different country. I have to do research on this different country and all of its different stances. And then I get to literally not be me, and I get to pretend that I'm a really fancy representative, you know, or delegation from a foreign country. And I thought that was super cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I realize how like nerdy and cool that is, but yes, I was nerd.
I feel like most people doing classics would be somewhere in the nerdy space, right? So, I'm doing classics and also I'm doing this nerdy thing. It's like, you're doing a nerdy thing already, so just embrace it.
Exactly. You know, that's what I say. You know, I was like, when little children think that, you know, calling someone a nerd or a dork was like an insult, I would just be like, mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. That's my normal Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Next. Like, I love being a dork. And so... I've always called myself a proud nerd. So I embrace mm-hmm. the nerdiness. And I will say I love people who are just as nerdy and obsessed as I am. So those are the best people. Yeah, I mean, people. I think
in some ways that's most people in grad programs, right? If you are, you want to encourage kids to do outdoor activities and blah, 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 and be physically active and all that stuff. But I also don't think it's a good idea to shame kids for wanting to do more academic stuff as well, right? There's plenty of room in the world for people who want both things. If you are doing research in your own time, then frankly, so were a lot of us. We just didn't call it that necessarily. Like when I was in primary school and I was spending a lot of time reading history books, I didn't call that research. I called that reading. It's just fun. It's just like doing what I wanted to do. So sometimes that looks like work and sometimes that doesn't look like work. And that's a very individual perspective.
I would agree though. So, I mean, okay. So we've been talking a lot about games and a lot about history. So now I'm very, very curious. Are there like ancient world classics themed, you know, like movies and TV shows that you find stick out really good in their portrayal of the ancient world? Like, you know, if you were to pick, you know, I don't know, like a top two, three, like what would you say would be maybe your favorite representations of the ancient world?
I think I'd have to put HBO's Rome in there. Not perfect, obviously, but does a pretty good job of representing some things that don't get represented a lot. Like just the opening credits where you get to see the kind of street graffiti and some of that stuff is really cool. Have you seen the new Thermae Romae Noa anime?
No.
Because I would have to put up there, actually. It's really good. I was not really sure what to expect, but I haven't seen the movies or read the manga or anything like that. But I really liked that. I think they do a really good job, actually, of portraying Hadrian and his reign and through the lens of this bath architect. That obviously not perfect, but nothing is perfect. And it's just a lot of fun. Oh, I don't know. What's a movie maybe that I would... I don't know. Gladiator's fun, but I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'll just leave it at two.
Yeah, no.
I'm sure I'll think of something later. I'll be like, oh no, I should have said this.
Don't worry. I know it's a really broad question because there's so much done. Mm-hmm. I will say, yes, Gladiator is actually like my favorite movie of all time. I know it's not like super accurate, but you know what? It's a good story. It's a memorable story. And that's mm-hmm. what I really care about. So, and I ask, you know, what you really enjoy, because now I want to ask, you know, about the ones that aren't so good, you know, are there any that you have like huge problems with because, you know, it's maybe a little so inaccurate that it's just not like what were they doing?
I try not to give too much of my mental space to things that I find not valuable in some way. And I'm not saying here that like things that are like quote unquote trashy do not fit into that, because that's definitely not the criteria I'm using. Like, is this intellectually quality, but do I get something out of it? So I don't know if I really have like a bottom list. I used to, the Clash of the Titans remake is still probably the worst 3D movie I've seen, but that's because the 3D was that post-processing 3D that doesn't look good, and it has nothing really to do with the movie. And actually I recently read a couple of articles on Deicide in Screen Media that made me want to go back to it, actually, and look at it for the story, right, rather than for that. I mean, with the ones that are bad, like, I have a fun relationship with bad movies that I really love them a lot of the time. So even when I think about, like, okay, the Troy movie or The Rock's Hercules, but they're not bad. They're just very particular modern receptions that focus on political aspects and remove mythical aspects and are doing a specific thing. And it happens that that thing is not something that people who are interested in classics are really wanting to see, because it's not focusing on the classics, it's focusing on the modern, reusing the material for the modern world. So even those, like, I don't have a bottom list is what I'm saying here.
No, that's totally valid as well. I mean, hey, there is a really good argument for there's some kind of value in everything, even if it's shitty. I only ask because I know I usually say, you know, like, did you see that Gods of Egypt movie with Gerard Butler in it?
I did not see that.
Okay, because, you know,
I did see, like, it. I did see that it was listed on Netflix the other day, and I thought about watching it, and then I didn't.
No, okay, yes, it's on Netflix, and I will say, it's worth a watch just because it's like, it's one of those that I would classify as so bad that it's good, which is really funny.
Okay.
So, because it's just, it's like ridiculous. It's a special kind of thing is all I'll say.
All right, well, but you've sold me on it.
Yes, I encourage you to watch it because I think.
This interview is over. I'm going to go watch that movie right now.
Perfect. You'll spend half your time like laughing at it because you're like, oh my gosh. But also,
I'm imagining now it's just going to be me sitting on the couch watching this movie, occasionally pausing the movie and just yelling with my fist in the air, Lexi!
I'm so here for it. Yes. I will be mad if this doesn't happen now.
All right, I'm on notice.
Okay, so since you're one of the few people who's into Rome, I get a lot of, you know, different ancient Greece type things. So I am curious though, from the Roman perspective, how did you actually find the eagle? I think it was done in 2013 with.
Oh, yeah. That was one of those two movies that were both on the similar topic, right? About the Lost Legion kind of thing?
Yeah, where he has to go and, like, redeem his empire. Yeah. So, you know, how from a, you know, sort of more...
I haven't watched it.
Really? Okay.
I kind of missed both of those, and I can't remember why exactly. I think it might have been that they came out just at a time where I was really busy with something else. Like, which is... So there was a period between... Basically all of my academic education between like honors and the end of my PhD, I didn't play computer games because I just didn't have time. And I also didn't really watch that many movies and that many TV shows during that time. I did my graduate school in Los Angeles, so I did watch a lot of movies, but not those for some reason.
Fair. Yeah, no. I just find it funny because they made some really, as I would describe them, curious wardrobe choices. It's very funny because I know that a lot of people, when they watch like classically themed, you know, media, whatever, some people will hyper-focus on like, what are they wearing? But a lot more people will tend to focus on like either storyline or just like the setting of the world around them. Like, do the buildings look ancient? You know, the sets and stuff. It wasn't like so grossly out of place that you're like, what is this? But also I was like, okay, this is definitely way more modern than anything they would have had. Yeah, I tend to notice the smaller details. So I thought it was funny. I was watching yet another remake of like the King Arthur story, the one with, and it's like really weird, So I was kind of, but I was bored and it was on Netflix. That kind of describes how I like, find half of my stuff. But, and I'm like, okay, but this is like Arthurian, old England. And then it's like your Arthur character like walks out in some like modern looking jacket. Thing with like buckles and something that maybe looked like a zipper at some point. And I was just like, you know, I don't really think even in that era, that wasn't a thing, like made out of materials that I'm pretty sure they would not have been able to make look that good. So I was just like, okay, this is, yup, super realistic.
I quite like that when it's done sort of intentionally and the whole thing has that vibe. So like a Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, where they've sort of transported the whole thing into a modern, like they're still doing Shakespeare in this sort of like late medieval thing, but everything is modern. And so it's, they've sort of, yeah, like that kind of tweak on it. So a Roman movie where, I don't know, like that old movie, The Warriors, that's kind of like The Odyssey, but it's set in 1970s New York. that sort of thing. No, sorry, it's not the Odyssey, it's the Anabasis. It's Xenophon's Anabasis. But also that's an adaptation of that story rather than actually doing that story in the Romeo and Juliet way. So I don't know, there's something kind of about that that I find quite attractive sometimes, where it's less attention to the historical detail in a way that is aesthetically works for the movie. So I, yeah. But a Stray Zipper, I can see, definitely see how that would, yeah, like,
yeah,
rubber just classes the wrong way. I did actually think, while you were talking about that, though, of my worst movie.
Yes.
Have you seen Amazons and Gladiators?
Yes!
So bad. Yes! So bad.
I remember that. I have not seen that in years, but I'm like, oh my gosh, wait now. I remember it. Oh, that was terrible. That was terrible.
I will usually give most movies like my full attention for the time of the movie. I'm the kind of person who like sits down in front of a movie and I'll take it as it comes to me. And then afterwards I'll think about it. And then I'll think, no, that ending didn't work, or this, like, I didn't like that in some way. But that one, I was just like, the whole way through, it was just like, what is this? What is this?
I think I just remember being very confused. Like, I don't think I even formed an opinion, because I was just kind of like perpetually in my head just being like, what the fuck's happening? Wait, what?
I don't even remember how classical it actually is. Well, like, whether there's anything that purports to be classical about it other than the names. But I don't know.
Not really. I mean, I'd have to go back and watch it. Ugh.
Yeah.
Do I want to subject myself to going back and watching it is the actual question.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
is
yeah,
it
yeah.
worth it just Netflix. To know, you know, enough to talk about it? Maybe I just look up like a summary on Google and then not watch it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't get, like, if it turns out it is like that kind of good, bad, then you would have missed out on an opportunity to rediscover the terribleness yourself.
I probably will rewatch it.
That's not a convincing argument.
Yeah, I probably will rewatch it just because, I mean, I really haven't seen, like, I think I literally watched it when I was in like high school. And so I would have had a very different opinion, because I knew I liked anything, you know, ancient or classically, whatever. So, but I hadn't, you know, picked up my major yet. And so I hadn't really learned. So no, I think I'd maybe not enjoy, but I'd find it curious to actually watch it and see how my opinions have changed. Maybe it'll be 10 times worse than I first saw it.
Right. Well, I mean, watch it with the idea of like, why are they using classical material for this? That would be what I'd say. Anytime you encounter like a bad piece of classical material, see what they're doing with it, and like, why are they doing that, and what does that say about the relevance of classics for whatever story they're trying to tell? That's how you rehabilitate any piece of classical media for my mind.
That's true. You know, and I will say, though, you had a point about sort of anachronistic shows and films. Because I was realizing as you were saying that, no, there are a few like that actually I really enjoyed. One of my favorite films growing up was She's the Man, which is obviously like Twelfth Night retold, but like in a really contemporary American setting. And I did like that. But also there's something a little different about like Shakespeare versus like anachronistic Homer. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it might not be good if you did it. I think you just have to find like the right way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know.
And all of the things like that do speak to the continued relevance of classics, even if they're not doing things about it that we as classicists like agree with, like why would you take the gods out of the Iliad or whatever, like even if they're doing things that we may or may not like, it's still interesting that they are doing things with that material, right? That is still relevant enough to use those things in a modern context in some way, right? And that's interesting, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously for the ancient world, people have like real strong opinions, you know, and actually there are some instances where I think I would appreciate something more if it wasn't portrayed, you know, accurately the way that we read about or whatever. I mean, I think one of my favorite examples is I love the Apple Plus show Dickinson. It's like a retelling of Emily Dickinson's, like, the height of her writing and her life story. And, you know, when you read about her, like in the history books, you read that like she's a recluse and that she was some, you know, tortured soul who never left her room in her father's house. And she was just like so sad. I think like the show puts it in a great way. They said, you know, Emily Dickinson was the original sad girl. And I was like, oh, I mean, okay, that's an interesting way to put it. And then, you know, you see this like anachronistic show where they like breathe life into her. And then she's like suddenly this like vibrant character who has, you know, like a passionate love story that apparently in the history books you would just, they completely ignore. And you're like, oh, so yeah, because her great poetry had to come from somewhere. You don't just like, I mean, I suppose you could write great poetry if you didn't have like life or whatever, but you know, the way that we just kind of ignore that in the history books. So I don't think I'd really want to see something like super historically accurate on, well, accurate, quote unquote, what we perceive to be accurate about her. So I'm like, no, you're right. There's definitely,
I mean, there's room for both, right? You can have the historical sort of like super attention to detail, like almost documentary style, like retelling the story, you know, really faithfully. But then like the way people put their different twists on it and reinvent it for different audiences, different times, different concerns is fascinating. It's one of the reasons why I think about games, like video games in particular, where there is usually a pretty strong narrative that has been sort of put on it by a modern creative team to tell a story they want to tell. Think of something like Hades or Phoenix, like Immortals Phoenix Rising or something, where they've turned a story about ancient gods into a sort of meditation on modern family affairs and various things. That's really cool.
Totally agree. So I just want to end the interview portion of the podcast. I have a couple final questions. When you were either in undergrad or grad school, did you attend office hours?
I don't know, actually. I definitely did in... Okay, so undergrad, I think probably not. Well, actually, I don't know. I can't remember. I just can't remember. I must have when I was a grad student. I need to talk to you about something. Can we arrange a time to meet? Rather than like, oh, what time is that professor's office hours? Let me go head along. Yeah, I don't know, actually.
No, that's totally fine. So since you don't remember whether you attended, you can frame this one in your experience as, you know, a professor yourself. So, you know, do you have maybe a particular, you know, favorite memory of when someone came to talk to you, or, you know, something that you found just particularly valuable, great office hours experience, but as from, you know, from the other side of things?
I really enjoy it when students come to office hours to talk about something that isn't like a directly course related thing. Something that you said in class reminded me of this totally different thing, or this thing from my other classes, right? Where they're bringing together knowledge that comes from like different parts of their like educational experience or whatever, or different parts of their life. Like, oh, I heard in this course that isn't about games that you do games. Can we just talk about games for a little bit? Yeah, of course we can talk about games, right? That sort of thing where it's like it's not specifically about the field, but it's about like a kind of broader intellectual life, I guess. Like that's the kind of thing that I like and enjoy the most. Other than, yeah, because if it's just like, okay, so I have this question about the essay, it's like, okay, all right, let's go. Or I don't understand this thing, or I just want an extension. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, that's great. And I'm always happy to see students to talk about like anything. But I think when there's something that shows that they have really been thinking about the stuff that came up in the class or whatever, and they're bringing it together with other knowledge from elsewhere. Because that's one of the cool things that we don't often think about as professors, I think, is that all of the students in our classes are not just taking our classes. They're taking a whole lot of other cool classes. And I really like to see it when that knowledge like comes together. Like, oh, I was taking the psychology class and this thing came up in there. And how does that relate to Thucydides? It's like, well, I don't know, that's a great question, let's think about that. Tell me about the thing you know. Tell me about this thing that you've just learned about, and then we'll talk about how it might apply to this thing that we're both engaged in here, right? That sort of stuff is, I think, where I sort of feel most excited about it afterwards.
And the last question I really have is, I suppose, you know, if you were to make a good case and convincing students like why it's a great idea to come to office hours, you know, like what would you say? Like why should someone come to your office hours?
That's the best way to make sure that I actually know your name. In a big class, it's, I mean, as much as I would like to be able to memorize everybody's name, it's just so hard to actually do that, especially in a big class. So when you have a conversation with somebody, like office hours are, like, come to office hours, go to office hours, people. Like, if you're listening to this and you've never been to an office hour for one of your professors, just go along, just introduce yourself, just say hi, right? It's great to be able to kind of put a face to a name on a roll book or whatever, and to like have some sense of, like, these faces that you recognize all the time. And that sort of, like, personal connection, I think, can be really, can make the university experience and the intellectual life of the university far more like your own, right? So that you're part of a community. And that is often something that is really valuable that people just don't do, right? If it's, yeah, it's an intellectual community, make the most of it while you're there. And that includes chatting to people. And to be honest, if you're not talking to me in my office hours, I'm probably just fiddling on a game, to be honest. Do this quick game design thing in my office hours or whatever. Oh, look, a student to talk to. Great.
I love it. Keep it simple. I want to know your name. Come talk to me.
Yeah.
Yes. Ultimate. Yes. Ultimate answer. So at the end of each podcast, I ask every single guest of mine if they would indulge me and read Percy Shelley's wonderful poem, Ozymandias. And then after you've read it, it doesn't need to be, you know, the longest, like, you know, analysis you've ever done. But if I could just get, you know, your general thoughts on, like, you know, why do people seem to connect with this poem? Like, why do we feel that it's important? You know, does it impart some sort of, you know, really interesting lessons, or is it just beautiful? Like, you know, go to town with it.
Cool. Well, it's good that you don't want the longest analysis I've ever done, because that would be like a 300 page book. We'd be here for a while. So I haven't read this previously. I should have practiced it in advance, but I didn't. So
no, it's better that you didn't. Goes.
Yeah, I thought that might be part of the authenticity of it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
All right. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, in despair. Nothing beside remains, round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. I really like it. It's really good. I kind of got tingles, actually, when I got to the My Name is Ozymandias bit. It's just so, yeah. So there's this thing where the pedestal says the words and it says My Name is Ozymandias, and then the way that I read it, I was continuing down to the lone and level sand stretch far away as if that was the voice of Ozymandias speaking, because it's not entirely clear where his words end and where narrator starts again. But I like that ambiguity, I guess, that maybe the narrator is saying these things and then all of a sudden he's passing off to Ozymandias, who is saying these things, including some things that are sort of describing the scene, which is this interesting kind of like liminal space there. This always makes me think of the Sisters of Mercy, because they use the line, the lone and level sands stretch far away, in one of their songs. And so I do have, like, this is a poem I do kind of think about it a lot, but the end part, right, those last five lines are what I usually think of, or maybe the last six. Like the framing, I met a traveler who said this thing, and then this is what he said, and in the middle of that is another speech, is the sort of those nested narratives inside each other, which is pretty cool. I've been thinking about that a lot recently with various games, actually, that use like an interesting framing device around the narrative, and then sometimes like stories within stories, like the Odyssey. Yeah. I think that's all I have to say.
That's really good, though. I mean, I've not heard it like that. Like, literally have not heard it like that. So, yeah, it's my favorite poem of literally all time. Yeah. I don't know what it is about it, other than it just, it like, evokes this sort of, like, ancient idea, right? And then you're like, hmm. Mm-hmm. I know, honestly, I've read this, and I've now heard it read to me more times than I can count. And every time I still get tingles, like I still just get all like goosebumps and excited. I'm like, Ozymandias. Yes, it's brilliant. I mean,
there's definitely something as classicists, not just as classicists, but particularly as classicists, probably we are very aware of the thing that we study not being around anymore. And that relationship with the idea of like ruins, things that are past. And now things that have upheld as having a certain type of cultural value, separate from the reality in some ways, because later culture has built the stuff around it, right, that says this is valuable, which is interesting to think about when we think about like ruined structures, as well as like intellectual structures, like the idea of the ancient world or the idea of classics. And so this meditation on someone very powerful in the past observing that his power is still there, but not there.
Yeah, no, it's the idea that it's definitely like a political piece by Shelley saying, you know, like power is fleeting. It's also, you know, you can't do it alone. You know, he thought he was so great, but like, you know, if you look at his civilization, which he thought would last 1,000 years or forever, it's gone. It's all buried in sand. And like, we wouldn't even know about it if it weren't for, you know, archaeologists coming and digging around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wouldn't even know the king unless he had the artisans make the statue of him. So, you know, yeah, you're great, but you can't do it alone. And power's fleeting. So I love that interpretation. And using that interpretation, the last question I ask on the podcast is, you know, if you consider our civilization today, you know, is there like a modern Ozymandias, something that we think is like amazing and gonna last forever, that, you know, maybe realistically in like, I wanted to say like 1,000 years, but I'm also like, LOL, global warming might just kill us in like 100. Yeah. So I'm going to go with like 100, 200 years, something, not maybe like 1,000, but like in like 200 years, you know, are we going to look back and just be like, were we insane? Like, what were we thinking? You know, like, so is there anything like that?
I mean, probably everything. Like if we were to time machine in the future, or if we were to go back in a time machine 200 years in the past, and tell people in the 18, 2022, hey, this is what people are going to, here's what we think in the future. And here's all the many ways in which we think that the way that you do things now is like bad or misguided. There'd be so many things. I don't know if I can pick just one, except maybe the entire sense that our civilization is the, I don't want to say pinnacle, because I don't know if people necessarily think that, although some people, like Fukuyama's end of history, like liberal democracy is the ultimate thing. It's like, okay, well, you thought that in 1989, even now, like 30 years later, it's like, that doesn't sound very prescient, actually, without even going to 200 or 1,000 years. Civilization is constantly changing. Like the way that humans organize themselves is constantly changing. It's going to keep changing. So I don't think that we have anything, whatever we think is going to be our Ozymandias, probably will be.
Great answer. Yeah, no, I love that question because I've gotten so many great different ones. I think someone said that.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Someone said like capitalism, and then someone else was like iPhones. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's brilliant. So
yeah.
Great answer. Yeah. Anyway, it was so lovely to talk to you. I'm so excited that we were able to connect and do this. I know, you know, yep. the time difference, luckily, actually isn't too bad between like Greece and New Zealand. I would be more stressed if I was in the US, like literally, what, 17 hours or something crazy behind. So it's
easier
like,
to calculate it the other way for the West Coast, right? Like there's 5 hours difference the
yeah,
other way.
And I was like, that's
5 hours
insane.
Difference yesterday.
Yeah,
that makes it really quick.
You know, it's so funny because like as like historians, classists looking at, you know, all these things, and especially after looking at like Ozymandias, I was just thinking to myself, you know, I was talking to a friend in LA because we wanted to schedule some time and we couldn't make it work because they're 10 hours behind me. And I was thinking, you know, this is like modern day time travel. Like, why are we imagining time travel when we're already doing it? Because we finally agreed on a time. It would be 9 p.m. for her. So at the end of her day going to bed, and it was 7 a.m. for me. So when we finally connected, you know, here I am kind of groggily with my like, you know, morning everything. And I'm just like, okay, I barely had my tea, but we're going to talk. Yeah. And here she is like settling in after a long day with her cats. And, you know, she's all like, oh, you know, I basically, you know, just changed into my pajamas. And I'm like, what is time? What?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like time travel. So, you know, I'm like, can you tell me what does my future look like? You know, how many hours in the future? Like, you know, am I gonna win the lottery today? Am I gonna run into luck?
I didn't look that up. I didn't get a Greek newspaper.
Darn.
I'm also like, I'm watching the Giro d'Italia at the moment. So I'm also like watching that delayed. So I'm like aware of something that's happening in the Mediterranean, but like 12 hours after it's already happened, more than like 18 hours after it's already happened. So
I missed my chance. So, well, I guess I'll just have to take the future as it comes.
Yeah.
Well,
like Ozymandias.
How terrible. No, I'm kidding. So anyway, yeah, no, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. And, you know, hopefully we can have you on sometime in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.